The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Also, guests you can call in to 914-338-0695 if you have any questions throughout the show. First, I will want to recap the theme of this show, which is the competent practices of medicine according to the standard of care is the leading cause of death in America. The Lord Daniels is the place where you can get honest answers that can save your life. This is a place to get your healing news you can use without all the technical mumbo-jumbo. Again, guests, you can call in at 914-338-0695. And once again, you're listening to the Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul, and this is your Lord, Dr. Daniels. Please visit Dr. Daniels at vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Today we have Dr. Daniels with us. Welcome, Dr. Daniels.
Hello.
Our topic today is a hospital. There is one near you. What is a homicidal hospital?
That's a good question. A homicidal hospital is one where the probability of death is increased just by admission. In other words, being admitted to the hospital carries a separate risk of death and injury that is unrelated to and additive to the patient's illness. So a healthy person would have a risk of death or harm just because they were a patient at that hospital.
Now, how do we know that a hospital is homicidal?
That's a really good question. It turns out that the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services has really looked into this. The Inspector General's job is to ensure that civil, criminal, or administrative action is taken against healthcare providers who break laws governing federal healthcare programs. And providers also includes hospitals. And so in November of 2010, the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services published a study. Actually, they published a study in 2012. It was based on 2010. And these were the findings. And it found that basically 27% of hospital visits or admissions involving Medicare patients resulted in patient harm. This was described as absolutely alarming, and they advised more research, of course, and tracking to find ways to reduce the harm. But patient harm is really endemic throughout all hospitals, and they found in their particular study that death of a patient contributed to or caused by being in the hospital was 1.3% of all hospital admissions for Medicare patients.
Okay, so why is the hospital homicidal?
Hospital homicidal because it's designed that way. The financial incentives, which is the more that a a hospital does, the more it gets paid for. The financial incentive where when a patient dies, the hospital gets paid. And the fact that when a death results, the payout is much more small than if the patient lives. So the financial incentives are one issue. Another issue is the administrative structure. And the administrative structure is of a hospital is now very similar to an administrative structure of any commercial venture, whether it's a warehouse or an airline company or a bank. And the other thing that makes a hospital so homicidal is the requirement to follow the standard of care. And so hospitals are also not designed or operated with patient input. And so whether or not the patient lives or dies is not a consideration in terms of the hospital's ability to function or continue to function.
So, Dr. Daniels, when did the hospital become homicidal?
Well, going to the hospital has always been a deadly experience. And people knew this and avoided them in the 1800s and early 1900s. And at the turn of the century, women could expect, for example, a 30% mortality if they had their baby in the hospital, whereas if they stayed home, the death rate for the woman and the baby was much lower. Doctors started washing their hands, and, of course, this death rate dropped. And then the usher of science was the era of science was ushered in. To this day, the mortality for home birth is less than the mortality for hospital birth. The safety of staying away from the hospital, though, has been obscured by the promise of research. There are new discoveries every day is what patients are being told, and they don't want to miss these discoveries by staying at home. And what nobody tells the public is that the new discoveries are in the future, and they do not influence the inherent risk in the present system, and often these new discoveries carry dangers of their own.
And I want to remind the guests that you can call in at 914-338-0695. And you're listening to the Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul, and this is Healing with Dr. Daniels. Please visit Dr. Daniels at vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk from murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, who made the hospital so homicidal? Sorry about that.
Well, there's really no one entity that made the hospital so dangerous. What made them so dangerous is that the mission changed. Instead of providing comfort, they changed to a place where drugs, tests, and technology could be marketed and consumed. The goal became to maximize the consumption of drugs, tests, and technology. And the goal became economic, not humane. When the staff changed from volunteer to paid, the focus shifted to marketing and covering expenses. Now, more than ever, the procedures done at the hospital can be done outside the hospital much cheaper and even in many cases more safely. However, this changes the locus of power and profit away from the hospital, and hospitals are rather powerful, and this is why it's been blocked. And so the individual, which is the patient, loses both power and money, and the hospital's gain under the present system.
And where did this all start?
Well, it all started when money became the measure of a successful hospital instead of patient outcome. The passage of Medicare and Medicaid really heralded in a whole new era, basically an influx of incredible cash into the system. And this was also associated with the closing of charitable hospitals, whose only goal was the provision of care. And it converted the system, the whole system, into a for-profit system. And what we are now seeing in the United States is a maturation and maturity of this for-profit system and the consequences.
Okay, I understand that. Now, what are the clues?
Well, there's a lot of clues here. As they say, circumstantial evidence. Hospitals have record profits in 2010 of 5%. Now, 2010 is the latest year for which we have figures, so we work with that. This is also accompanied by a rise in complications and hospital-related deaths. Hospital-related deaths occur in 2.3% of all admissions. This is determined and confirmed by New England Journal of Medicine research study. So since the revenue from an admission that results in death is, on average, 4.3 times that of an admission where the patient goes home alive. Deadly events caused by the hospital, these are caused by the hospital, not the disease, constitute 9.89% of all revenue. So if profits are 5% and deaths caused by hospital revenue, by hospital action, are 9.2% of revenue, eliminating all hospital-caused deaths could easily bankrupt the hospital. In other words, eliminating all deaths caused by hospital action would cause 9.89% of revenue to be replaced by 2.3% or a drop of 7.59%. This would more than wipe out all profits and close most hospitals. The next area for consideration is the 27% of hospital admissions that result in non-fatal harm. Well, remember, the hospital gets paid for responding to every complication that happens. The events may be tragic for the patient or represent a cost on the accounting sheet of healthcare economists, but they are much-needed revenue to the hospital. Most of the hospital's costs are fixed. This means that a hospital cannot reduce its cost by 15% because admissions are down 15%. This means that each hospital begins the year making commitments to staffing and equipment and then spends the year finding ways to expand the revenue to fill the commitments. Complications and homicides seem to have filled this revenue gap. Clearly, eliminating non-fatal harm in hospitals would be akin to telling McDonald's it cannot offer fries, a revenue generator, with each meal. A medical complication or patient harm in a hospital is akin to a revenue generator or French fries in a hamburger joint. However, unlike French fries, the patient is not consulted and does not have the opportunity to decline this add-on. So most hospitals now are run by MBAs and have much in common with the people who run the banks that are presiding over foreclosures.
Now, what is the mechanisms for this homicidal behavior?
Well, hospitals now have the authority to write health protocols that become the standard of care. They also influence doctor behavior. In a current case, there's a criminal investigation ongoing of a large hospital chain that is suspected of rewarding doctors for unnecessary admissions and medical procedures in order to boost revenue. When I was in medical practice, I would actually get calls from the hospital encouraging me to increase the number of admissions and procedures because, of course, the hospital wanted more revenue.
Now, for those who are just joining us, you can call in at 914-338-0695 if you have any questions. Also, to remind everyone that you're listening to the Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul, and this is Healing with Dr. Daniels. Please visit Dr. Daniels at vitalitycapsules.com/findout to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, is this homicidal being rewarded?
Yes, this behavior is definitely being rewarded.
Okay, now how is this behavior being rewarded?
Well, this behavior is being rewarded the only way that it can, through insurance. Once a person is dead, they cannot pay their murderer, but the insurance can, and it does, reliably.
Now, why is the patient so powerless?
Well, the patient does not pay directly for the hospital care. The patient pays all right, but he pays through an insurance company, an employer, the government. If the patient did pay directly, the system would have to listen to what, when he asks how much. He could then ask the next question, what results can you guarantee me for my money? He could then make the next decision, which is no thanks. I would rather take a vacation, buy another car, leave the money to my heirs. I mean, after all, that's what the hospital executives would do with the money.
Again, you can call in at 914-368-695 to ask any questions. And just a quick reminder to those that just turned in, you're listening to the Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul. This is Healing with Dr. Daniels. Please visit Dr. Daniels at vitalitycapsules.com/findout to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, wouldn't this financially ruin the patient?
No. All research shows that when the patient is presented with the total cost in advance of receiving medical care, financial ruin does not result. The patient says no and chooses to spend his valuable time and money elsewhere. Also, health expenditures decrease by 67% when patients ask questions and get answers. Patients can add an additional measure of safety by indicating that in the event of their death, they instruct their heirs to pay no hospital bills. This works very well for uninsured patients. If you have insurance, you can contact your insurance company to see if you can exercise this particular option.
Now, what about the impact on health of the patient?
Well, a lot of people worry that if they can't afford health care, then maybe they might not get health care that's necessary, that's really needed. And studies show the individual who lacks health insurance to cover their hospital stay has one-fifth the chance of dying as an insured patient. So actually, it makes the hospital stay a lot safer. And mysteriously, even though hospital-caused deaths have been increasing, the uninsured people seem to have a rate of hospital death one-fifth that of the people who are insured. So it appears that not having insurance, paying out of pocket, one, does not cause financial ruin, and two, is not harmful to the person's health.
Now, could you explain to us the purpose of the hospital then?
Yes. The hospital is part of a larger economic system made up of the pharmaceutical industry, insurance industry, and hospitals. It is at the level of the hospital that profits are maximized. And it's through the hospital or at the physical location of the hospital, and because it exists, that maximal doses of drugs are given or can be given, and this maximizes profits for the pharmacy industry. Maximal harm is done, thus discouraging future use by insured people of the hospital. So if a person goes to a hospital and they experience physical harm and they survive it, then they're much more likely to not come back to the hospital and to continue paying their health premiums but not using it. So this actually increases profits for the insurance industry. And then those people die that might become profit-sucking cases in the future. So in other words, a person going to the hospital has an increased chance of death. That person who goes to the hospital is also, just by the very fact that it went to the hospital, a high user of insurance. And so them having an increased risk of death actually lowers the total future cost for the insurance company because that person dies at that encounter instead of living a long time to just have high cost year after year. If the hospital were a safe place, nobody would need insurance. And this is because simply the elimination of harmful care and deadly care, as well as useless care, would cut hospital bills by 90%, just because that amount of care would not be provided. But unfortunately, profit happens when patients experience complications and death. It is the administration of harmful care that causes the profits and the deaths. In other words, harmful care is also the source of profits for the hospital.
Very interesting. Now, once again, listeners, you can call in to 914-338-0695 if you have any questions. And you are listening to the Blake Radio Rainbow Soul. This is Hillary and Dr. Daniels. Please visit Dr. Daniels at vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, are teaching hospitals safer than just general hospitals?
No, and in many cases, they're worse.
Is this because of the doctors in training?
That would be the medical residents? Actually, no, it's because of policies. There's a greater willingness to use methods that do not have a track record of safety. Often a last hope intervention will prove deadly when the patient would have lived without it. And these last hope interventions are more likely at teaching hospitals. An example of this is flecainide, a heart drug that proved deadly. It was first introduced at teaching hospitals where research papers were produced that hailed its effectiveness. It was then released for use in all hospitals and went on to kill more people than the Vietnam War.
Now, can you give us a personal example of this?
Yes. And the example I'm going to give you is an example of a case where the standard of care would likely have resulted in death and what happened when the standard of care was not administered. Now, just for the sake of the listening public, there's something called advanced cardiac life support. And this is a protocol of different drugs that are supposed to be administered in a particular sequence when a person's heart in the hospital stops beating or beats with a, you know, a deadly type rhythm where intervention is needed. And I was a resident at the time, and as a senior resident, it was my responsibility to show up and pitch in during these times when advanced cardiac life support was being administered. And generally, the room would be filled with 7 or 8 healthcare professionals working in a cooperative manner to revive this person. Well, I'd been to like 5 of these sequentially, and each time the patient died. And so I made up my mind that when it was my turn to be in charge, I was going to do absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. And see what happened. So sure enough, one night I was in charge. I had the emergency red beeper on my side as well as my regular beeper. The emergency beeper went off, and yep, flashing red. Somebody's heart somewhere stopped, and the numbers flashed up, and I said, oh, it's the dialysis unit. I ran out the hospital, down the hill, into the dialysis unit, and thank God I was the first person there, which put me in charge as well as being a senior resident that night. So when everyone else showed up, I said, okay, great, take a blood pressure. And the nurse took the blood pressure and read it off to me. I said, great, take it again. And then she did that, and I said, take a pulse. And then I just asked people to just check the patient, look here, look there, but did not administer any drugs at all and did not follow the protocol. It took about 3 minutes, very long, 3 minutes, but 3 minutes, and the patient on his own started breathing and his heart started beating. Well, everybody was very upset why I didn't administer any drugs. That meant that the amount the hospital got paid was less, but the patient lived. So we took the patient to the intensive care unit. Specialists took over from there. Again, this is an example where the person had what medically we call a life-threatening emergency. In fact, I mean, his heart had stopped beating, for Christ's sake. And we had a protocol to follow. And following that protocol, time after time after time, I noticed every single patient died. And the one time I decided, you know what, I'm not following that protocol, patient lived. Maybe it was luck, maybe it wasn't. But even if it was luck, what that suggests is a lot of times when life-saving intervention is pursued, one, it's not necessary, and two, it may actually be harmful.
Well, that is very interesting. Now, what policies make teaching hospitals especially dangerous?
Well, teaching hospitals are more likely to have research relationships with drug companies and use unproven therapies. Also, there is a practice at all hospitals, as well as teaching hospitals, of turning a blind eye towards dangerous doctor behavior as long as the behavior is profitable for the hospital. And so a doctor really, even though he may have a record with a very high number of deaths, or notches on his belt, so to speak, as long as the insurance companies have been paying and compensating the care he provides, then the administration doesn't say anything, and any doctor who has a negative opinion about it is encouraged to keep it to himself. Also, creating protocols that maximize revenue and not allowing doctors to deviate from these protocols. For example, when I was a medical resident, residents were expressly instructed not to intervene in any way if an attending doctor is providing care that appears to be harmful or even deadly. Not the young doctor's job to save lives, just learn. Nurses, similarly, are instructed to follow a nursing process and not to deviate. Even if the patient appears to be worsening, each employee is instructed that someone else is overseeing the big picture. They need only attend to their little piece. And hospitals monitor the deliverables. In business terms, this means you only measure the final outcome, which is profit, now that hospitals' goal is profit. So there's no daily measure of patient quality of life, patient satisfaction, patient improvement. The hospital does not get paid for these. There's no mechanism for the patient or their family to intervene if there's a problem with the care of their loved one.
Now, can you give us an example of this?
Yes. When I went to medical school, I also went to business school, and we were in a business school, I majored in healthcare administration. And often I was present at board meetings, hospital board meetings. I served on hospital finance committee meetings, all kinds of situations where decisions were made about patient care, very important decisions. And I noticed there's never, ever anyone present who represented the perspective of the patient. But one example that really brought it home was when I was in medical practice in Syracuse, New York. I had a practice in an inner city area. And as a result of that, I got a lot of publicity. People say, how could you keep your practice going in that area? So my name was always in the newspaper, TV, radio. And so one point, there was this patient in the hospital, not a patient of mine. And the patient had congestive heart failure, kidney failure, diabetes. The patient was getting worse. And the family, this is one of the local hospitals, complained to the attending, who was in charge of the patient's care, the doctor. They complained to the administration of the hospital, and there's no resolution. The patient continued to get worse. The doctor had a consult come and see the patient, but the patient continued to worsen. So doctor and administration did meet, but the discussion focused on limiting the liability that might result from the family suing when the patient died. Meanwhile, the patient worsened. Finally, I get a call from the office. The daughter of this patient is distraught. She tells me the doctor's trying to kill her mother. She wants him off the case. Now, I knew that there's no way to directly remove a doctor from the case. I did, however, know the doctor in question, even personally. I also knew the medical director of the hospital personally. And I also knew a competent specialist who would probably solve the problem and save the patient's life. So I called the doctor in question. He was relieved to hear from me and to have a way to get rid of the patient. I called the medical director and asked him how a transfer could be made. It was a complex process, but all the doctors agreed to it. I then called the new doctor who agreed to accept the patient and transfer. So everyone agreed to a transfer. The daughter was happy. The patient got transferred, was under the care of the new doctor, and 8 years later was still alive, which is the last time I checked. Now, had the family not called the doctor, unconnected with the case, the doctor who knew the inner workings of the hospital, the doctor didn't mind getting involved, the patient would have died. There was no mechanism in place to incorporate family or patient feedback into the care plan. And so just following the standard of care was considered okay. If the patient died, well, that's okay, because just follow the standard of care, and that's it.
Dr. Daniels, how are the hospital infections being made worse?
Well, the cause of these hospital infections is being ignored because the disease is so profitable for everyone involved. The hospital profits because it gets paid 4.3 times as much for infected patients and even more for those who die. Antibiotic manufacturers profit because they sell antibiotics to use in animals, which causes the illness in the first place, then sell more antibiotics to the hospital to treat the resistant infections or the illnesses that they caused. So exposure to antibiotics is the cause. More exposure to newer, stronger antibiotics is making it worse and increasing the death. So the contagious mode of transfer is being addressed when use of antibiotics is actually the cause. The most profitable standard of care when it leads to death is being followed in the case of hospital infections. This is dressed up with hand washing, gloves, gowns, and masks. The big show of cleanliness draws attention away from the issue that the patient is getting antibiotics that cause the MRSA and has holes in his skin, which are IVs, that allow MRSA to enter and kill him. So these positive events have not been addressed, and instead they focus on other aspects.
Now, once again, I want to remind our listeners that you can call in to 914-338-0695 if you have any questions. Also, you're listening to the Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul, and this is Healing with Dr. Daniels. Please visit vitalitycapital.com/find out to find out your risk from a medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, what are the financial implications of this?
Well, the financial implications of this is more money. Or as they say in the hood, more money. The hospital receives 4.3 times the revenue from a patient that dies of MRSA than from a patient that lives. And this relative multiplier is the same for any patient that goes to the hospital. So if you go to a hospital and you get discharged alive, chances are you stayed about 4 point some odd days, and your hospital bill is in the area of $5,000 to $10,000. If you get discharged to the morgue, in other words, dead, chances are you stayed 10 or more days, and your hospital bill is in the range of $40,000, $45,000, $50,000. So this means that there's a financial incentive to have as many deaths as possible from MRSA. And this is facilitated by classifying the deaths as accidental. We can see the effects of this as the incidence of deadly hospital infections continues to increase each year.
Now, what is known about the harm that they're temporary but not fatal?
Well, harm that is temporary and not fatal actually forms also a very important role or part of the hospital's profit mix. According to the Inspector General Medicare report, the harm that is temporary but not fatal represents 3.5% of payments to hospitals. In other words, hospital income increases 3.5% as a result of reversible harm to patients. Again, the record profits in 2010, 3.5% of this was from harm that was reversible.
Now, what about other diagnoses?
Well, there are other diagnoses unrelated to infection, but there's statistics on these as well. So when a patient's admitted and discharged alive from whatever diagnosis, again, the hospital gets in the area of $8,000 to $10,000. When a patient dies in the hospital, the revenue from a visit is 4 to 5 times as much. And again, the incentive is to have as many deaths as possible to maximize revenue. The financial reward for murdering patients, the cultural bias against criminal investigation, and a monetary penalty that is paid by liability insurers, not the hospital, make this the perfect crime. High reward, low probability of detection, and low penalty. Great crime.
Wow, that's pretty... guests, I just want to remind you all to call in to 914-338-0695 if you have any questions. And those that are just tuning in, you're listening to The Blake Radio, and this is Rainbow Soul, filling with Dr. Daniels. Please visit Dr. Daniels at vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, what other things make the hospital homicidal?
Well, one huge factor that makes a hospital homicidal is the hospital food. If you're not sick, it will often make you sick. Now, because hospitals now more than ever are run a for-profit model, the cheapest, most processed foods are what's purchased. Also, it is common for food vendors to have connections to the board of directors. Like prisons, the people eating the food have no choice or input. In many countries outside the United States, the families provide food for the patients. This is actually healthier, as the food most families cook at home is of better quality than what's served in hospitals. Also, even a family with poor cooking practices will change their cooking for the better and bring better food to the hospital. We have a question. I could take this question, and I'll give you an example of a patient that actually got better by not eating hospital food.
Perfect.
Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hi there. This is Ms. Snyder in New York. How are you, Dr. Dan?
Fine. How are you, Ms. Snyder?
Fine, thank you. My question, did I hear you correct that the hospital get more money?
Yes.
How did we allow... Type of deadly, call them negative laws to exist. How does that work?
Well, it's not a law.
More money by you dying in there. Is it through research grants or what?
No. The way it works is the more a hospital does, the more it gets paid. But each thing the hospital does has a risk of death. And so the more things a hospital does to you, the greater your probability of death. And they've actually crossed this out. It seems that once you cross that $40,000 to $50,000 threshold, you kind of go down this really, kind of almost like falling off a cliff. Your chances of dying from the therapy just escalate because at that point you've experienced so many therapies, each one with its own risk of death. It's like death by 1,000 blows, so to speak. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you.
Oh, okay, you're welcome.
Anybody else? Questions? I have a few on the conference.
Okay, oh, great.
Anybody else? Okay. We're going to listen.
Okay. Put your hand down, and then you can put it back up again when you get another question.
Oh, how do I put my hand down?
Press 1, caller. And I should have put the hand down.
No, it doesn't look like it did. Oh, well, why don't we just go a few more minutes, and then we'll check back for more questions.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay, so as an example, I had this patient, I had this neighbor when I was a little kid, like 10 years old. And around that time, 10 or 11, I decided I'd be a doctor. I thought, oh, this would be so much fun to be a doctor, and I could take care of all my neighbors, and wouldn't this be fun? So then fast forward 20 years, and here I am back in the neighborhood, bought a city block, built an office building, and I'm taking care of my neighbors and friends. And so one night, I got home late that night, it was after dark, and I knock on the door, I open the door, and it isn't my neighbor from childhood. And she says, Dr. Daniels, they are killing my father, and I think that they're just going to kill him, and I want you to go right down to the hospital and save his life right now. I said, wait a minute. So we figured out that he'd been in the hospital 5 days. He survived it this long. I said, why don't I go in the morning, okay? I'll go in the morning and check it out. So I went there in the morning, and sure enough, he was not doing well. He didn't know his name. He didn't recognize any of his relatives. He was all swollen up from heart failure. He had some oxygen on, and they decided they weren't going to give him a heart transplant, even though he needed one, because, well, he had diabetes and a few other things, and why bother? And so I said, man, this is, I'm not a miracle worker, but, I can do what I can, but I can't guarantee anything. He says, well, just do whatever you can. So it turned out that the father was actually fairly wealthy. He's a businessman, and they had also stopped by the office to have me certify power of attorney. This guy's totally incompetent, that they were going to handle all of his affairs. I said, okay, no problem. It's obvious this guy's incompetent. So what I did is whipped out my prescription pad, and I said, okay, here's the deal. No hospital water, no hospital food. Tore off that piece of paper, handed it to her, so I'm writing it down so you know what to do. And this is what you feed them. And so I told her exactly what to feed them. And even though before he came to the hospital, they were feeding him some deadly food, she actually went to the health food store, cooked up exactly what I told her, and bought it in to feed that guy. And in a matter of 4 days, he was off his oxygen, off his heart medicines, walking, demanding his car keys, and ready for discharge. Now, if he had been allowed to simply persist with hospital water and hospital food, he would have had the predictable outcome, which is what the cardiologist told him. Your father's going to be dead in 5 days. Don't worry. We got it under control. And so he left that hospital and lived at least another 10 years, to my knowledge. So in other words, 10 years later was the last that I checked. But this is an example of how just the food, just the hospital food, is so deadly. Yeah, we have a question here. Let me check this question.
Okay.
I'm clicking this button here. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if there's a big do they make a lot of money on handicapped people when they die or when they go in the hospital?
They make the money when you die. So going into the hospital is not enough. What happens is it's not that they actually have to kill you in order to die, but in order to profit, but the amount of care that they need to administer in order to maximize their profit is enough to kill you. Or put another way, when you have a living, breathing person and you administer care, you get paid for administering the care. Then you administer more care, you get paid for that. And each care is a little more stressful. Maybe this one's an IV, and this one's going to be a tube you put in the bladder, and this one's going to be an X-ray with high-dose radiation, and, oh, let's take another look, another X-ray with high-dose radiation. And then, oh, let's put another tube in over here, and on and on and on. And so you pile up the activities to pile up the billing, and it just seems that the human body can only take so much, and then it just expires.
Yeah,
and
well,
that's,
you know,
that's the mechanism.
Sure. Well, I was going to ask you more about bladder infections. Like, I used to have one a lot, and I had some kind of procedure, and I never went back and followed through on anything, but I did notice quite a bit of pus after the procedure. And then I thought, I wonder if that's been in there a long time, you know. But at any rate, what I'm wondering is, what are we eating? What is in the food? Is it dye that's making us feel like we have to go and urinate all day long, and so they're giving us a drug so we don't feel it? Is that what it is?
You're right. There are a lot of drugs in the food. The biggest drug, there's so many drugs in the food. The biggest drug in the food that's causing the biggest problems appears to be antibiotics.
Antibiotics.
And that's a huge one, yes. The other thing that's in the food is, that's really the topic of next week's talk, is MRSA, the methicillin-resistant staph aureus, which is in the hospitals. One-fourth of all the food in the United States or meat is tainted with that infection. And so here you are eating this infection all the time, and it's wearing down your immune system.
Yeah.
And you're eating these antibiotics all the time. So if you're eating meat and dairy from the grocery store, you know, you go to the grocery store, you pick up a package, you put it in your cart, and you check out, if that's the way you get your food, then you're getting a lot of antibiotics.
Would anything like any kind of processed cheese, would that also be bad because of all the hormones too?
Well, processed cheese is another matter. Processed cheese is filled with plastic.
Right.
So you're not really even eating food.
Yeah, that's what I even heard about olive oil, that they have plastic in olive oil.
Extra virgin.
Yeah, extra virgin even has plastic in it.
That's another issue. Once they have a food that becomes so popular, like maybe extra virgin olive oil or agave nectar, then what happens is very soon people's desire to eat that or purchase that becomes greater than what the natural supply is. I mean, there's only so many cactuses in the United States, right?
So how are
you going to make agave nectar? Answer, you use something else. You put it in a bottle and you label it agave. And so this is a big issue.
Now, I heard that corn silk is good for bladder pain. Is that true? And where would you get it in the wintertime? Can you get it from a health food store?
Corn silk is good for bladder pain and bladder difficulties because it's a diuretic. It makes you urinate more.
Ah.
So another question is, what other herbs cause urination that might be available in the wintertime? That's another question.
Yeah.
Because the answer to that would be parsley. Carrot tops.
Okay.
So these are other, and you use the same way you would have prepared the corn silk, you know, by boiling it, making a tea. You can do the same with these others. Celery is another one, celery seed.
Okay.
So all of these things can give you a similar effect.
Okay, great. Well, I don't want to take all your time. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay.
Now, Dr. Daniels, Dr. Daniels?
Yes.
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Sorry about that.
Oh, wait, you have a question here. Yes.
Yeah, you said...
Is that Ms. Snyder?
It's not good either?
What's not good?
What was that, that type of honey? I'd probably...
Agave, yes. I personally wouldn't eat it. I would not eat it or recommend it, no. Because
it's not better than honey.
The latest evidence is that it's adulterated. Honey is healthy if it's raw and not pasteurized. And so a lot of the honey on the shelves is pasteurized, and so it's actually not healthy.
So what is the best sweetener?
The best sweetener. I would use the green stevia. There's cloudy white stevia. There's liquid clear stevia. There's powdered green stevia. So use the powdered green stevia as a sweetener. Another sweetener, if you really want something that tastes sweet and sugary, would be brown raw sugar. It is still sugar, but at least it's raw. It's got a few minerals in it. It's not as bad. But the best thing I'd recommend really is to eat ripe fruit in place of sweet stuff. So in other words, if you have oatmeal in the morning, cut up sweet ripe fruit in there. So cut up your apples and stir it into your oatmeal raw so the apples still taste sweet. Whereas if you cook your apples into your oatmeal, it's going to taste sour.
How about the tea?
What I would recommend is eating tea that's naturally sweet, like cinnamon tea is naturally sweet, or licorice root tea is naturally sweet.
Thank you. I am so surprised. I thought that nectar, agave, good stuff.
Right.
Top dollar for it.
Yeah, no, just more marketing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, Dr. Daniels, I guess to get back is, now what is the solution for all of us for this problem?
You know, there's quite a few solutions, but I'm in favor of something really, really, really simple. So basically, you get what you pay for. You do not get what you do not pay for. Right now, there's a financial mechanism in place that pays for death. In order to get less death, we have to stop paying for death. So what I would recommend is if the patient dies during hospitalization or within 30 days of discharge, the insurance company must pay the full amount of the hospital charges that would be due to the hospital according to any existing contract. This amount is not paid to the hospital but to the family, the surviving family. At the family's sole discretion, they can then pay as much or as little as they like to the hospital and doctors. This new rule is revenue neutral to the insurance companies as they are not being penalized.
Now, would there be any restrictions on how the family could spend the money?
No. How the families or heirs choose to spend the money is their decision. Whatever amount the family chooses to pay to the hospital and others involved in the care of the deceased is accepted as payment in full, and no further bill for medical care may be issued by any doctor, hospital, ambulance, or entity involved in the care of the deceased. The money is paid as per existing laws governing inheritance or disposition of assets according to any will the patient had in place. The money may not go to the government. It must be paid to a survivor of the deceased or a charity designated by the deceased.
Now, once again, listeners, you can call into 914-338-0695 if you have any questions. And this is a quick station break. You're listening to the Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul. This is here with Dr. Daniels. Please visit vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, is there any other actions that should be taken?
Yes, absolutely. Whenever a hospital death occurs or a patient dies within 30 days of leaving the hospital, there must also be a full investigation using crime scene investigation tools and homicide protocols. If it is determined that the medical care received was in any way contributory to the death of the patient, homicide charges must be leveled against the doctor, nurse, ward clerk, administrator responsible for that department, and pertinent members of the board of directors. Hospital administrative memos pertinent to the event also must become discoverable. And people don't realize, by the way, that when a patient is going down this trail to death, once you reach about the $10,000 to $15,000 mark, the memos start flying in administration because this is all being monitored. Memos start flying, check with the insurance company. They want to guarantee payment's going to happen. And if the insurance company says, no, we're not paying, care stops. And guess what? The patient lives. So all these memos, flurry of memos in the background, become discoverable. They should be. And as with any homicide, accomplices, accessories, and other co-responsibles would be culpable. In other words, open to prosecution.
Now, would the family be barred from taking other legal actions?
Absolutely not. This should in no way limit the family's right to sue under malpractice, wrongful death statutes, or diminishes any other payments they may be entitled to.
Now, what about needed care that might be life-saving?
Yeah, there's always a fear. Well, would the hospital then say, hey, wait, we're going to withhold life-saving care because we're not going to get paid for this? Possibly. However, there's little evidence that care being provided by hospitals is life-saving. Only 15% of medical care is a proven benefit to patients at all. The hospital knows this. In this case, they have any doubt, they need only look back to the last 50 deaths. They will see a pattern of drug use and or doctor involvement. Since the motivation for these murders is financial gain, removal of the financial gain will likely reduce the death rate and motivate hospitals to eliminate these patterns of death of care that lead to death.
Now, what new regulations would be needed?
Absolutely none. CSI, the crime scene investigation crew, already exists. The amount that the insurance company pays out is unchanged, so no special compensation fund needs to be created. The amount is already determined by existing agreements between the hospital and the insurance company. This is a free market solution that involves existing laws and personnel. The patient's will or legal framework for distribution already exists. The family does not even need to fill out a form in order to receive the funds. A simple death certificate, which is completed as a matter of routine course, is all that's needed.
Now, I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to The Blake Radio, and this is Rainbow Soul and Healing with Dr. Daniels. Please visit vitalitycapsules.com/find out to find out your risk for murder by medicine. Now, Dr. Daniels, what impact will this have on hospitals?
Honestly, eliminating homicide from hospitals or even minimizing it will cause most hospitals to close. This means that we have to find other employment for those who work there. However, homicide should never be okay, even for the sake of job creation and increasing the tax base. You know, I think we have another caller here with a question. Let me see if we can...
Oh, I'm back.
Hello, caller, you're on the air?
Yeah, hi. I was just curious about xylitol because I understand that it's not made out of birch. It's made out of corn now, which would probably be GMO. So I was just wondering, is that correct?
Would not recommend it. No, I would not recommend it at all.
Okay, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
And so what do you do with what you have? It's not even good for cleaning your teeth, is it, if you just used it to, like...
No, I would not do that. I would, dig a hole in the backyard, bury it, and hopefully it won't hurt the plants.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, Dr. Daniels, thank you so much for all the information that you gave us tonight. Now, what do we have for our listeners next week?
Well, next week is really exciting. Next week I'm going to talk about MRSA, that's methicillin-resistant Staphylococcal aureus. It's that flesh-eating bacteria, the plague created by modern healthcare. I'm going to talk about how to prevent it and how to survive it if you do get it. So let me just check back with our callers and see if anybody has any questions. We can see if anybody has any questions. Oops. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Just want to check back, see if you have any questions.
Yes, I do. Hi.
Yes.
My sister was killed 51 years old in the hospital. Gave out. It was so quick. I did file a homicide report that the doctors did kill my sister. Oh, in other, it was just.
What year was it?
This was last year, 2011.
Oh, okay. Who did you file the report with?
The local police department.
Okay, that was your mistake. You have to go to the district attorney.
Who?
The district attorney's office.
I did get a copy.
Yeah, but that's where you have to, the district attorney, and just really, really lean on them, really go after it. The other thing you can do is you can get a copy of your sister's records, and you can look up the drugs that she was on or that she received and see if any of them caused the condition or the diagnosis that they say she died of.
She never had a heart problem that gave her killed her. But 51 years old.
Young lady, yeah, exactly. I don't know what she went to the hospital for, but chances are, had she stayed home, she might still be alive.
Do you mind if I email you what I sent?
Yeah. You can shoot me an email. For those of the other listeners who might want to email, it's support@vitalitycapsules.com.
No, I have. Okay, thank you. I'm just glad you're addressing the topic.
I couldn't believe they might not go in there in a deadly state. I couldn't believe what they did. This topic is crucially. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the thing to really keep in mind is that nothing personal. It doesn't matter the race, the gender, or even the income level of your sister. This is happening to people of all income levels, all racial backgrounds, and both genders. And that's what's so shocking. And so many people think.
Black people?
Excuse me?
Is there not a higher disproportionate rate on black people through, you know,
Well, there's the big issue, the biggest thing that's going to save your life is if you're a self-pay patient. So if you're paying out of pocket for your hospital care, your chance of getting deadly care are literally one-fifth than if you were paying through an insurance mechanism. And especially if you're paying through an insurance mechanism like the government, it's not good. Your survival is definitely diminished.
Wouldn't it be, I would assume it would have been the contrary. They don't want to be bothered with money.
No, it's not that at all. It's a matter of them knowing that they're going to get paid for administering care that's deadly. In other words, if you know that you're going to get paid whether the patient lives or dies, then you're not really going to worry about whether or not they die. But if you know that if they die, you do not get paid, then it's like, oops, let me pay attention to that. Like, I was in private practice. I had a cash practice, not an insurance practice. And so I was very concerned. I didn't want my patients to die because if my patient died, I had to go look for another patient. If they live, then they keep coming back to me, and they send me their relatives and their friends. It worked out pretty well. So I was very, very, very concerned. And as a doctor, I would actually see people. I said, well, wait a minute. The last patient that took these five steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, ended up dead. And, of course, fifth step was going to see the specialist. So I'd say to the patient, look, you're on step 2 here. This is a five-step sequence to death. And so I'm going to tell you right now, you do not have to take step 3, 4, and 5 if you don't want to. If you want to, I respect that. It's up to you, your decision. But I'm going to tell you, the last person that walked this path ended up in the ground. And so if you have relationships with your healthcare providers, well, they only get paid when you live, then that changes everything. And that's really where you want to move to.
How do you control that?
Excuse me?
How do you control that they get paid only if you live?
You're the one paying. That's how you do it. You keep your insurance card in your pocket, and you say, you know what? I live, you get paid. I don't live, you don't get paid. Now, let's talk. And they'll even tell you up front, oh, well, then we can't give you any care. Great, I got it. I understand. In other words, they'll tell you we intended to kill you. It's like, okay, I'm out of here. You know? They'll tell you. They don't mind telling you because there's no criminal penalty for killing you. So they don't have any problem telling you to your face that it was their plan to kill you, and if you're not going to let them kill you, then you can't, you know, then they want nothing to do with you. So you just have to ask. And you can't ask if you use your insurance because they've already called the insurance company to make sure they're going to get paid whether you live or die. They got that covered. As soon as you show your insurance card, that's it. Fate is sealed.
So if you go in there, hide the card.
So I'm telling you, you got to just tell them, hey, you know what? It's you and me. Let's work it out. Okay. We're coming up close to ending time here. I'm going to take one more question. Thanks a lot, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. I'm going to check with this one other caller and see if they have any more questions. Oops. All right, caller, we got like 30 seconds. You have one last question.
Oh, it's not the other person. I keep hearing muted stuff. I was just curious, what's the best way to wake up people that are so brainwashed by the hospital system and think that they're really there to help us and they love us and they really want us to get well?
The first thing to do is, again, to listen to this broadcast. Listen to this broadcast, the one you just heard, and listen to next week's broadcast and just keep listening. I also have a series of comic strips I've written. This stuff is so out of hand, all you can do is laugh at it. That's how outrageous it is. So have them get on my email list at vitalitycapsules.com. Send them comic strips. They can listen to the radio. And they can figure out their own pace. They don't have to feel like you're jamming it down their throat.
Great. When are you going to have your new capsules done, the next, the better brand?
I think it's going to be about 8 weeks. I'm doing a new blend now, a milder blend.
Okay.
And actually, I'll send a notice out about that.
Okay. Very good.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Okay. That is it. I think we're going to close the show.
Make believe.